This is The Urban Connection, the weekly show on issues that affect the community.
Memorial Day is all about remembering those who paid the ultimate price to defend their families, their friends, and their country. For those soldiers who did return home, a frightening number of them suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. This week, we'll talk with a former Army captain who shares some of his experiences in combat, the scars left behind, and his optimistic view of lessons learned in battle.
You know, what you don't expect is I lost 8 men that deployment, and 6 came from one incident. It was a tough fight.
I'm Leonard Birdsong. The Urban Connection starts right after this.
Now, The Urban Connection continues. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Hello, folks. This is Leonard Birdsong back with you on The Urban Connection. I have a good guest with me today. His name is Jeff Morse. He's a real leader. As a matter of fact, he's always been a leader from his days as an all-conference college football player and a team captain. He then went into the military. He was in the U.S. Army. He was an infantry officer, and he won the not the Purple Heart, as I remember, but the Bronze Star. And he's now a vice president of operations with one of the nation's leading financial services. Jeff, thanks so much for being on the Urban Connection. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Leonard. Absolutely. It's my pleasure to be on. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity, so thank you.
Well, you know, I read your book, and it is a good read. It's called Legion Rising. And it tells about not only your life, it's sort of autobiographical. It goes from the fact that your father, I guess, and mother divorced early, and you worked with your mother when she was delivering newspapers. You were 6 years old. You were helping her, and you went to college, and then you did well in college, played football, and then you got into the military, and you had a outstanding, I guess you might say, career in the military. 2 tours in Iraq, in Baghdad. You were platoon lieutenant, but you were platoon leader. And then yeah, a company commander.
Yes.
Okay. So I thank you for what you've done for our country, and I'm sure the other people would like to, you know, do the same thing. I was not in the military myself. I was a foreign service officer, so I served overseas in some places. But it's not like being in combat. I want to ask you a couple of questions. Why did you decide to go into the military? I know that one time you wrote that you wanted to be a Navy SEAL, but that didn't work out. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into it?
Yeah, I did. And it started with sort of the initial idea of what I want to do with my life. Like a lot of kids back in the early 90s, I saw Silence of the Lambs, and I decided that I wanted to go into federal law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, and this was, probably my junior year of high school. And so a lot of the advice that I got from people was the best way to get into federal law enforcement is to have spent some time in the military or have a law degree. And so the initial thought, and one of the reasons I went to Samford University where I did, was one was football, obviously, as you mentioned, but Samford had a great law school, Cumberland School of Law. And mm-hmm. I kind of thought that may be a better long-term career track. That way I would have a fallback, you know, with a law degree. But it was about halfway through college. I had always been a student of history, in particular military history. And just that draw, the challenge, the physical challenge of what the military brought. So it was about, and it's in the book, I actually say it was the day I sat down to take the LSAT with the day I just sort of had this. So you gave me a hard time on the phone last week. You must have done better than me. And you probably did, because like right then and there, I just knew my heart wasn't in it and I wanted to do something else. And having grown up on the beach down in Destin, Florida, having spent my whole life in the water, just going to the Navy and being a SEAL seemed to be the ultimate challenge. And as you mentioned, after I graduated college, there was actually about a 5-year delay before I actually went into the service. And that was due to Well, the first time I applied for the Navy and SEAL program, this was pre-9/11. They weren't accepting a whole lot of guys like me off the street to go in and be an officer, but I was young, 22, 10-foot and bulletproof, and thought they would take me. And sure enough, they didn't. The recruiter told me they wouldn't, so I was going to go through the process again the following year, and I was having some lingering shoulder problems from playing football, and ended up having to have two shoulder surgeries, and the second one was reconstructive surgery, and the Navy said, well, we'll never take you with a surgery like that. So that was 2000, and then it was, well, shoot, I'm not going to the military. I don't have a law degree. What next? And so that's when I left Florida and moved out to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and began a career with a company out here.
Yeah, and if you did very well with them, but you got an opportunity to go into officers' candidate school. Is that right?
I did. You know, and things got off to a good start with the company, and then 9/11 happened, and just like everyone else, I felt that urge to give it one more shot. I felt like I would always wonder what if. And so at this point, I was a little over a year removed from the surgeries and made the decision at this point. Things hadn't gone so well in the Navy, and I realized with a little bit of years and wisdom how difficult it was there. So I picked the Army because the Army was the one branch that would at least, even though I wanted to eventually go the special operations route, at least I could get infantry guaranteed if I went into the Army. So I chose the Army.
And you ended up leading 158 people in a mechanized infantry support and security group. And this was in Baghdad. You did it not one, well, twice, I guess. You had the first time you were a platoon lieutenant and then a platoon leader. And then later on, you got to be the company commander, right?
Yes. So my first deployment was from spring of 2004 to spring of 2005, kind of right when the insurgency really kicked off in Baghdad, or in Iraq, I should say, was right about the time we were getting there. So that first deployment was a tough fight. It was an infantry platoon leader. I had 34 men under my command. We had 27 Purple Hearts for injuries sustained in combat, but fortunately did not lose anyone. We had a couple of serious injuries, but was able to come home with everybody that we went over there with. Yeah. And then came back and do a series of jobs, just the way the military progresses, and had a pretty unique opportunity to stay in command, basically of the same group of men that I had been with the first deployment. There was a few little nuances there, which is very unusual, and I won't bore you or the listeners with kind of how that works, but it's very unique for the company commander to have served as a platoon leader in that same unit. And it was a great opportunity. So I just took over an expanded role of responsibility, was promoted to captain from lieutenant, and went back for my second deployment back to Baghdad. That was in October of 2006. And as soon as we got there, they announced the surge. So our 12-month deployment was now going to be a 15-month deployment. And we were in a very dangerous part of town. My first deployment, I was more central Baghdad. And the second deployment, I was more eastern Baghdad, kind of in the outskirts of Sadr City, which is a notoriously bad part of town. And it was a tough fight.
Yeah, and you lost some men in that second deployment, and it was hard on you. Really was. I don't want to go in too deep in the weeds of it, but if you want to tell us a little bit about it, tell us, please.
You know, going into that environment, you expect that things like that could happen. You know, what you don't expect is I lost 8 men that deployment, and 6 came from one incident. 4 were killed instantly, and that was March 15th, 2007.
A date you'll never forget, as I understand.
No, my life is just so wired by dates and anniversaries, and we can get into the pain they used to cause, and now it's almost more of a celebration. But yeah, so we lost 4 men. 2 were severely injured in that same incident. 1 died a few days later on March 18th from his injuries. And then the 6th one, he'd passed away from his injuries on March 21st. And what really made it all the more difficult was the reason those 2 lived temporarily was the heroic actions of a young man named Jimmy Kuhn, who had jumped out under fire that day and gave medical aid to temporarily keep them alive. And, you know, obviously he was very, very well respected before that. But after doing that, I mean, he was just kind of the example of what bravery looked like on the battlefield. And just to show you how cruel war can be, about almost 3 weeks after that, on April 4th, 2007, that young man was shot and killed by an enemy sniper. And then it was 2 months after that, on June 3rd, 2007, where we lost the eighth man, Caleb Christopher, in an IED attack.
I understand that this kind of firefighter, the firefight you were in, has given you a lot of motivation to work in the business world. And the you know, supposedly you have been taught by some of this operation over in Baghdad to help you with your business right now. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, and I would like to think that I had this grand plan going into it. I think it's been an evolution over the years as I began my, call it my corporate career, a little bit later than most, in my almost mid-30s. And what I found, and I equate it back to Iraq. Now, things are different now, but when I went in, this was, you know, we were still in, heck, we hadn't even invaded Iraq yet. And so a lot of the training and tactics that we studied were all based off conventional Army techniques. Think, if you want to just give maybe an example that everyone would relate to, like think of us fighting the Soviet, you know, army on army type deal. Then you're thrown into an environment in an insurgency, and it's just a totally new fight. And, you know, you're going up against an inferior, you know, numerically inferior force that has to employ different tactics in order to be effective against a numerically superior force with better weapons and better technology. And so they learned to kind of expose some of the weaknesses in those conventional tactics. And so what we in turn had to do was adapt our ways, adapt on the fly in many cases. And so if you really want to dummy it down, I learned that there's the way and then there's the other way. And what my first deployment really taught me is, you know, in that particular environment, more often than not, it was the other way that usually ended up leading to success. And kind of kept the same mentality through my second deployment. And a lot of it was just my, you know, my leadership style. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's right for me. And so bringing it back to the business world, if you look at just the advent and the exponential growth of technology into business and society today, and a lot of people that are in senior leadership roles kind of, again, if you want to call it, grew up in the conventional manner of, you know, you do X, Y, and Z, and you manage a P&L in this regards. And so what I try to do is just take a look at it of, I had this old saying of, you know, think like the enemy and always take the time to think about where the other person's coming from. And I think sometimes in business, we get so caught up in our goals and our focus and, you know, what success means for my organization that we don't take the time to think about, you know, the other side has a vote as well in this. And so I try in my business career to really kind of put myself in the shoes of whether it's a third party vendor, whether it's the customer. And all right, here's the way we've always done it. Now, what is the other way that we can leverage and utilize technology? And in some sense, take that numerically inferior, instead of a force, now it's a technology that exists, and apply it to, you know, just be a force multiplier for the numerically superior organization that I'm a part of.
We're talking with Jeff Morris, former U.S. Army captain, about the challenges faced by veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome. Jeff, stand by. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with more of The Urban Connection.
More of The Urban Connection, straight ahead. Stay tuned. Let's return to The Urban Connection. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Welcome back. For this Memorial Day weekend, our guest is Jeff Morris, a former U.S. Army captain, platoon leader, and company commander who fought in Iraq during two deployments. His book, Legion Rising, is an honest account of his combat and the scars of PTSD. Before the break, you mentioned a furious firefight in Baghdad, and you've written that that experience helped you in business. Can other people learn from this?
I think you can. I think you don't have to go through an experience to learn from someone else's experience, if that makes sense. And I've always... A lot of these ideas that I mean, they're not unique to me and my men. It may have been one of my peers and something that he went through. And I would sit down and I would pick his brain. And now that I'm in corporate America, I network constantly across people of multiple industries and just try to get an idea of what different people are doing. Because I can only scale so much as one person, but if I leverage this larger group that I'm a part of and their experiences, then collectively, you know, I can take this collective group of thoughts and experiences and kind of mold them and cater them towards what fits me and my style and my leadership.
Now, you have written, and I've seen this in the book and some other places, that you are a motivator, and you are such a motivator, you found ways to make people run through a wall for you if they had to. There are three things that you need to know to get people to become this motivated. Can you tell us the three things?
I think that may have been maybe a little embellishment in the words, but what I take a lot of pride in is, and again, so many of these things go back to lessons learned in the military and just how I've been able to apply them to the business world. And sometimes you think you have to have all the answers, and when you stand up in front of a room that you should be able to answer every question and you should be the first one to talk. And I think oftentimes the leader, the thing you need to be the best at is you need to be the best listener in the room.
Right.
And
right.
I think that, you know, people in corporate America, they throw around terms like, I want to hire good people and empower them to do their job, when oftentimes what they mean is, I want to hire people that will do what I tell them to do. And I take a lot of pride in, no, I really want to empower my people. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is just everyone that has ever worked for me or worked with me will say that with Jeff, I know I always have a voice. It doesn't mean they're always going to get their way, but they know they have a voice. And I kind of have a running joke. If there's 15 people on my team, I'll tell them, all right, every one of you has a vote and it counts for one. And I have a vote and it counts for 16. I can always overrule you, but you know, but very rarely do I pull that out, because I've yet to be a part of an organization or team or lead a team that I was the most experienced person on there. So I take the time to listen to what those around me are saying, and embrace the fact that I don't have all the answers, but I'm surrounded by people that do. But again, at the end of the day, the buck's got to stop here with someone, you know, so you got to be willing to take on that responsibility. But I think listening, kind of a long-winded answer to your three points, listening is one.
Yes.
Two is I call it tactical patience. In business, everything is this quarter, you got to drive this, you got to drive that. And, you know, the world just gets in such a hurry and it's not going to slow down. But in the military, you know, you had this idea, if you want to go and just go running down an alleyway and kick in a door and just overcome everything through violence of action. And that can be an effective technique at times, but more often than not, show a little tactical patience and let the situation on the ground develop. Take the time, again, back to point number one, show some tactical patience and listen to what other people have and their thoughts on it. And don't delay a decision, but show some tactical patience to make an educated and informed decision.
Right.
And three is people. And that sounds cliche-ish and kind of hokey, but I've yet to see a company and they talk about their seven principles or five tenets of leadership, whatever it may be. People is going to be in every one of them. Yet I think sometimes we forget that. I don't think I know that, because people become a commodity and it shouldn't be that way. And when you take the time to hire someone and mentor someone, you're not just making a difference in their professional career. You're making a difference in their personal career, better livelihood for them and their family. And as leaders, I think that's something that we should embrace. We always say command didn't stop the day. Leadership didn't stop the day that I left command. And the same principle applies. Leadership doesn't stop when it's 5 o'clock and you leave the office. Be there for your people. They truly are the greatest resource you have. Without them, you are nothing. And just because people are going to make mistakes, you're going to make mistakes. But never, ever forget the people component of this, because without that, we're all going to fail.
Well, no, these are great words of wisdom. I know that many of the people who listen to this program have been in the military, and I think that they need to hear these kinds of things. But we're going to sort of switch horses here, and I'm going to talk about something that's very tough for maybe you to talk about and others to talk about. It's overcoming the trauma of PTSD. It took you a while to come back down to earth, I guess you might say, and you had to do it your way. So tell us a little bit about how you overcame this.
Yeah, and it's I kind of laugh. I spent 5 years, you know, when I got out, almost 5 years, never talking about it. And now people say, like, you never shut up about it. Because But yes, I mean, like you said, I mean, I was a part of some really tough times. And I saw some really horrible things. And I seen things that you literally cannot unsee. And those things don't go away. And, you know, you combine that with the survivor's guilt. You know, it's something that I have to wake up every day and know that I made decisions, and that that eight men lost their life because of those decisions that I made. And I'm not trying to be overdramatic, because I'm objective enough to know that I made 99 other decisions that day and nothing happened. And we only seem to remember and recollect the one when things don't go our way. But still, you know, I kind of equate it to, you know, I'm an outgoing guy. I'm the life of the party. I like to get out, meet people, and try to stand up for those that can't stand up for themselves. That was the norm. And if I ever had an off day, that was kind of an exception. And then over time, through these experiences, if you go back to 2008 and 2009, well, the exception became the norm. And I didn't realize it. It wasn't some conscious thing that I was just falling into a dark place. I didn't turn to drugs or alcohol or abuse any of those. I still enjoy beer as much as the next guy, but I never abused any things of that nature. I never, you know, was in the parking lot with a gun in my hand ready to commit suicide. But I was just a shell of who I was. I came back, you know, combine all the, you know, the personal demons that I was going through. I mean, you read the book, the prologue, the incident in the mirror with the cut on my face.
Yep,
you know, that was something that haunted me to a point where I couldn't bring myself to look into a mirror. I mean, I brushed my teeth in the shower. I kept shaving my head when I got out, so I didn't have to look into the mirror. I didn't want to see that image again. You know, then combine that, I was now my ex-wife, we had had our son right before that deployment, and we split. So I started going through a divorce. So yeah, there was a 5-year stretch where on paper, things looked good. I had a good job making good money, but I was just,
you were numb. That was the word you used.
Yeah. Just totally numb. And outside of the love for my son, I literally did nothing to develop or cultivate any relationship of any kind. And then it was, you know, like any, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go on with what you're going to say.
Yeah, no, it was, I'm a 45-year-old grown man, but it took my mom to sit me down one night and say something to me that just kind of changed my life. And it made me realize, that I was a shell of who I really was or used to be. And that B, most importantly, that I was being a hypocrite. I had stayed in that command mode, and my man, we had at that point several suicides from the unit since we came back, guys struggling. And when guys would call me, I said all the right things and gave them the right advice. But the fact of the matter is I never took any of that myself. So I decided to try to, you know, set the example that the leader can't help heal unless they're healed themselves. And so I began the steps of, you know, and I didn't know how counseling was going to end or what it was going to turn into, but at least I could take steps to do something. And through that, you know, what ultimately kind of helped me, you know, rise above it, kind of back to the theme of the book of rising, is just the power of choice and acceptance. And I always had this idea in my head that if people knew some of the things that I'd seen or that I'd done or been a part of, that they would just, you know, paint me with this scarlet letter. And so I just sort of accepted that I was always going to be different, and people treated me different. So it made me feel even more different. But then I just, you know, acceptance is not a, I told my counselor, I said, you know, it's not a one-time deal. I don't sit on your office today and sit here on your couch and say, you know what? I accept these horrible things happen to me in life. I'm good now. But it made me realize that it's a daily choice that I get to make, and I can choose to focus on the privilege of, you know, the pride in wearing the uniform and the camaraderie and brotherhood with these men and these great experiences that we did, or I can choose the burden of some of those horrible experiences. Let me tell you, the choosing the privilege feels a heck of a lot better. And in 9.9 out of 10 days, I make the right choice, and I still do it to this day years later. But, you know, every now and then, some of these anniversaries are tough and things come back and you kind of have an off day. But the beauty of it is I get to wake up again tomorrow and make that choice again. I always want to make that choice of being a catalyst for good.
We've been listening to Jeff Morris, and he's written a book called Legion Rising. Thank you so much for coming on, Jeff. I wish you continuing success in your corporate affairs and your life. Keep up the good work, Jeff, okay?
Thank you, Leonard. You too as well.
And that's it for this week. I'm Leonard Birdsong, inviting you to join us again next time for more of The Urban Connection.
That wraps up this episode of The Urban Connection with your host, Leonard Birdsong, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of The Urban Connection.